The next day was even worse. None of us felt able to make our usual sardonic jokes at the morning meeting. The first case was a man who had died as a result of an entirely avoidable delay in his being transferred to our unit. Another was a young woman who had become brain dead after a hemorrhage. We looked glumly at her brain scan. "That's a dead brain," one of my colleagues explained to the juniors. "Brain looks like ground glass." The last case was an 8-year-old who had tried to hang himself and had suffered hypoxic brain damage. "Can we have some rather less depressing cases, please?" someone asked. But there were none, and the meeting came to an end. As I was leaving, one of the neurologists came down the corridor looking for me. He was sporting a 3-piece suit, a rarity for hospital consultants in the modern age, but instead of looking his usual jovial and positive self, he appeared a little hesitant. "Can I ask you to see a patient?" he asked. "Of course," I replied enthusiastically, always keen to find more patients for surgery, and hoping for a benign tumour, but a little worried by his expression. "The scans are on packs," he said, and we went back into the viewing room, where his registrar summoned up a brain scan on packs, the digital X-ray system, on one of the computers. "She's only 32, I'm afraid," the neurologist explained. "Oh, dear," I said. The scan showed a large and unmistakably malignant tumour at the front of her brain. "It seems to be a bad week." We walked to the day ward where the patient was lying behind curtains on a bed. She had had the scan 20 minutes earlier, and the neurologist had only just told her in broad terms what it showed. A young mother with 2 children. She had been suffering from headaches for a few weeks. Her husband was sitting by the bedside. It was obvious that they had both been crying. I sat down on her bed and did my best to explain what treatment she would need. I tried to give her some hope, but could not pretend that she was going to be cured. With these terrible conversations, especially when the bad news is being broken so suddenly, all doctors know that patients will only take in a small part of what they are told. I sent her home on steroids, which would get the headaches quickly better, and arranged to operate next Monday, promising her and her distraught husband that I would explain everything again when she was admitted the evening before the operation. It does not feel very good to tell somebody, in effect, that they have an incurable brain tumour and then tell them to go home, but there was nothing else to be done. Next morning, I showed her brain scan to the juniors at the morning meeting. It appeared on the wall in front of us in black and white. I told them the story and asked David, one of the younger trainees, to imagine that he had been asked to see her after the scan, as I had been the previous day. I asked him what he would tell her. David, normally full of confidence and enthusiasm, was silent. "Come on," I said, "you've got to say something to her. You must have had to do this before." "Well," he fumbled for the words, "I'd tell her that there was an abnormality of the scan with the mass effect." "What the fuck will that mean to her?" I said. "I'd tell her she needed to have an operation so that we could find out what it is. But you're lying. We know what it is, don't we? It's a highly malignant tumour with an awful prognosis. You're scared of telling her. But she'll know it's bad just from the way you look at her. If it was a benign tumour, you'd be all smiles, wouldn't you? So what are you going to tell her?" David said nothing, and there was an awkward silence in the darkness of the X-ray viewing room. "Well, it's very difficult," I said in a gentler tone. "That's why I was asking you. When I have had to break bad news, I never know whether I've done it well or not. The patients aren't going to ring me up afterwards and say, Mr. Marsh, I really liked the way you told me that I was going to die. Or, Mr. Marsh, you are crap. You can only hope that you haven't made too much of a mess of it. Surgeons must always tell the truth, but rarely, if ever, deprive patients of all hope. It can be very difficult to find the balance between optimism and realism. There are degrees of malignancy with tumours, and you never know what will happen to the individual patient in front of you. There are always a few long-term survivors. Not miracles, but statistical outliers. So I tell my patients that if they are lucky, they might live for many years, and if unlucky, it might be much less. I tell them that when the tumour recurs, it might be possible to treat them again, and, although to some extent it is clutching at straws, you can always hope that some new treatment will be found. Besides, most patients and their families will research their disease online, and the paternalistic white lies of the past will no longer be believed. Nevertheless, sooner or later, most of the patients, like Helen, will reach the point of no return. It is often very difficult for both doctor and patient to admit that it has been reached. The juniors in the morning meeting listened in the dark in respectful silence as I tried to explain all this, but I do not know if they really understood. After the meeting, I went back onto the ward to see Helen. Mary, the ward sister, came up to me. The family are completely unrealistic, she pointed to the door of the side room where Helen was lying. She's obviously dying, but they just won't accept it. What's the plan? I asked. The family won't let us treat her as a terminal case with decent painkillers, so we're trying to get community services and the GP organised and get her home. And the wound? I dreaded the answer. It looks like it's going to break down any moment. I took a deep breath and went into the side room. To my relief, the family were not present. Helen was lying on her side, facing the window, so I walked round the bed and squatted down beside her. She looked at me, her eyes large and dark, and slowly smiled. The right side of her head was swollen but covered by a wound dressing. I saw little point in uncovering it, so I left it undisturbed, and spared myself a sight any surgeon hates. A once neat incision for which he has been responsible, breaking down and becoming an ugly, gaping wound. "Hello, Mr. Marsh," she said. It was difficult to know what to say. "How are you?" I offered. "Getting better. Head hurts a bit." She spoke slowly, her speech a little slurred by her left-sided paralysis. "Thank you for operating again." "We'll get you home as soon as we can," I said. "Any questions?" I resisted the temptation to get up and walk to the door as I asked the question. An unconscious trick all doctors have to fight against when faced by a painful conversation. Helen said nothing, so I left and went to the operating theatres. Chapter 12. Glioblastoma. Noun. The most aggressive type of brain tumour derived from non-nervous tissue.